and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is November 24th, 2024, and this is episode 485. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in the greater Rochester area of Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Canada. And how you doing, John?
Pretty worn out. I'm in Victoria now. We're on the other side of Vancouver Island. We picked up all our stuff, including this 3x2 meter battle painting from Kurdistan. And about, you know, 2 tons of books. And we put it in an SUV and drove it all the way over the mountain, fully expecting a snowstorm and luckily getting only a rain bomb. Even then, we had to be preceded by this vehicle that had so many lights. It was like a anglerfish ballet ahead of us. And we made it. We made the long, long trek down to Victoria, deposited all this stuff, and it's now winging its way to southern Italy, and we're free of it. And we both agreed, Catherine and me, that even if it gets stolen, you know, even if it gets swallowed by sharks after a shipwreck, good luck to the sharks. May you have as much joy of it as we did.
It's not a sort of mental burden anymore, and probably you had to pay something for it. But at least it's like, well, you've checked that off.
Yeah.
And you've done your job. And if the fates have different plans for it, then not your problem.
And much like other creatures in the grand old nature kingdom, we are now ready to float downstream and die, getting paler and weaker every rivulet.
So you guys are going to be there for a little while now that you've got all your stuff moved out. And that stuff's been sitting there since, I guess, if people have been, you know, for those who've been reading you for a long time, that's been there since you last lived in British Columbia and Canada. Going back like a decade, right? A decade ago.
Yeah, it's and miraculously, it was pretty much unscathed and unmolded. All our carpets from Kurdistan were eaten by moths, but that seemed like a small price to pay.
Yeah,
and we were just so damn tired. But it was easier to throw away a carton of carpets that you've been smudging through the rain than put it in the car. It's one less motion, and it was easier. So now we got to head back to the rental place on the other side of the island, cross the mountain again, hope it isn't snowing. And if we go off the edge of the mountain, I salute you, Radio War Nerd guys.
All right, so we have a great interview with old friend of the show, Kelly Vlahos, and so let's get straight to our interview. All right, we are really happy to have back with us friend of the show, Kelly Vlahos. She is the editor of Responsible Statecraft, aligned with or part of the Quincy Institute. We have a lot of friends of the show who published in Responsible Statecraft or are affiliated with the Quincy Institute that have been guests on the show. Kelly, Kelly's one of our first guests, actually, when we first started tinkering or trying out guests. That was back in episode 36. Seems like a long time ago. That was June of 2016 when you did this great takedown or expose on all the North Virginia mansions from the global war on terror and Afghanistan and all that stuff. And then Kelly joined us again after Trump's shock victory in November of 2016 to talk about what a Trump foreign policy might be, because it was just everyone was in shock. And it was a giant repudiation of sort of the whole post-Cold War foreign policy consensus. And then we had Kelly back on 4 years later, episode 258. I'll post links to these on Biden's foreign policy, what might be expected. So this is 2020, what might be expected from the new incoming Biden administration, and looking back a bit on Trump's and, you know, successes and failures, such as they were. So first of all, anyway, Kelly, thanks for coming back on the show. Really glad to have you back on.
I'm very excited to be here. And wow. It has been a while, but I feel like every time we talk, there are serious moments in foreign policy and political culture. And I'm glad to share my insights with you once again on yet another serious moment in politics and culture.
Yeah. I mean, what's great about having you is that you're in D.C. And so you have a very good sense of what goes on in D.C., but you're not part of the blob. So that makes it great to talk to you because we can get some honest talks. I mean, I have to admit, it was kind of fun talking to you in November 2016. Fun to hear about the whole blob going completely crazy. But reality was a little different, but at least we had that moment, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I have to ask you the burning question, Kelly. Sorry, Mark. How are the new mansions? I somehow think of the theme song for The Sopranos while somebody's going to work past McMansions stretching up to the sky.
Well, I have to say I'm in Arlington, Virginia, which I did talk about in that article back then about the deep state. Listen, the deep state as defined much earlier than even Trump, but the deep state meaning the urban metropolitan DC, they call it the DMV, DC, Maryland, Virginia space, and how it reflected the largesse of the global war on terror. And I wrote about it then, but I have to say the property values have even gone up higher than they were at that period. And so like I live in a very modest neighborhood in Arlington, not your fanciest. It's right in the center of Arlington. And I've had houses directly next to me and across the street go for $1.5 million.
Wow.
And people moving in with that, not seemingly a blink, younger people. And I was just talking with a friend. I'm thinking, what do these people do for a living? I know one works for the government, but you know, there are so many ancillary careers in DC. Mm. So people think of it as just being federal government workers, but that's just sort of the narrow slice. The rest are all like the parasitical ecosystem of consultants and lawyers and lobbyists and think tanks, contractors, and it is such a lucrative business if you can get it. And that's, I mean, I'm focused on the defense industry, of course, but that again is just a small slice. So you have people that are involved in, you know, the pharmaceuticals, finances, tech, human rights, the entire panoply. And I say human rights, meaning the sort of like internationalist blobosphere that you have connected with the IMF and the World Bank and all of those tangential groups and careers. And so there's just so much going on here and people making a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it's because all the money is here, you know. And one of the things that I agree with my Republican friends are the taxes. Like if you could get more of the money going out to the states and have the states do what they need to do to rise their people up, whether it be education or development, infrastructure, what have you, I think a lot of our problems might, I'm not going to say resolved, but the fact that that money is just sitting in Washington and going to this ecosystem that I just described does not help the people outside the Beltway. It might be in small amounts, but just think of what would happen if you didn't have this big trough here. And the trough was disseminated to the states, and the states could decide what to do with it. I know that sounds oversimplified, but I think that's a lot of the anger that you hear from people outside the Beltway about the swamp, is that they pay these huge taxes and it just sits here, and it's going to people to build, you know, $1 million houses and live lavish lifestyles.
Right. it's centralized. I mean, it makes sense. And there's an old American tradition. It's not as alive maybe as it used to be, but against centralization and right. for decentralization. But, you know, the powers that be have even found ways to make decentralization kind of Trojan horse centralization sometimes. And it's very, very hard. And especially like when the sort of the centralized apparatus in the DMV, as you described it, like it gets to a point where it's always in its interest, of course, to keep coming up with reasons to keep centralizing all of those money flows. And it becomes like a circular thing where it just, it's really hard to dislodge that, like really hard, I would think. And so, yeah, then, and you know, that's, I think one of the main issues that we're going to talk about too, which is empire. I mean, it's not the entire thing, as you pointed out. There's a lot of other grifts going on, but empire is a very big one. And it's surprising to me, I don't know, maybe we talk about this a little later, but one of the things that kind of surprised me about the national security state, the empire, whatever you want to call it, is that I always had a sense, or I had a sense certainly since the end of the Cold War, that that big business, plutocracy, whatever you call it, was uber alles, and that even the national security state sort of took, I don't know, to some degree, kind of, you know, second fiddle to that. And what we're seeing with China, though, is that really the national security state is the number one. Like, because there's so much big business that doesn't want to break with China. But for the national security state and what they think is their interest, or whether that interest is pecuniary or imperial or whatever, or America first, you know, they do think that. So we do need to talk about, you know, the empire here. I guess, though, first of all, let's start with sort of the larger question. Are Trump's picks so far, you know, Marco Rubio, and, you know, Pete Hegseth and Elise Stefanik at the UN. I mean, does this show any difference from Trump 2016 or how Trump actually, you know, ran his government in his first term? I mean, what do the picks so far say to you about what Trump 2's presidency is going to be like in terms of foreign policy?
I mean, the biggest difference that I see are he has gone straight loyalist. So every single person that he has chosen for top security spots are people that he knows that will be loyal to him first and foremost. When he picked John Bolton, for example, Mike Pompeo, some of the generals, I felt like he was picking them because of their security experience, whether we agreed with them or not, more so than their loyalty. I think he felt burned by that experience on several levels, whether it be Stop the Steal after the 2020 election, or the fact that they had left and then talk smack about him, or in the case of Jim Mattis had actually quit because Trump wanted to get out of Syria. So there were a number of experiences that obviously led him to make a change and say, okay, I'm just putting loyalist in. These are not, to me, the second thread is that they are not necessarily America first. I say that because I can't pick one out of the top security spots that aren't anti-Iran, pro-Israel. I feel like that is the through line. And that is, to me, that's not America first. I don't see any one of these picks outside of his own vice president, J.D. Vance, who actually did say before the election that it was not necessarily in America's interest to go to war with Iran. And he pointed out that Israel was an ally, quote marks, because they're not technically an ally, but they were an ally that, and for whose interests might diverge with American interest at times. So he was the only one in this Trump orbit, this select inner ring, so to speak, who has ever talked about American interests when it comes to the Middle East. The rest of these candidates, whether they be picks and appointees, like the National Security Advisor, Mike Walls, and deputies, Seb Gorka, and the others that don't need to be confirmed, like the ambassadorships, you know, all of them have records in which they have either called for going to war with Iran, have exhibited this sort of pro-Israel, evangelical Zionist approach to our foreign policy with Israel and Iran. And that, to me, that's the most concerning thing about this, because I felt like we spent the last 8 years cultivating a lot of voices within the Trump movement for restraint and intellectual arguments for realism and restraint. And it was out of those conversations and discussions and that movement that J.D. Vance emerged, and to some extent, Vivek Ramaswamy as well, and people like Elbridge Colby. And what we're seeing here is Elbridge Colby has been left behind. Vivek Ramaswamy is in this new enterprise with Elon Musk to cut the budget and the federal bloat. But aside from J.D. Vance, none of the people that we thought might be brought into a new Trump administration, at least the security state, have emerged. It's all very hawkish, very primacist, very Cold War-esque, if not neocon. And it's a big disappointment to a lot of people in our space.
Would this be the same for Ukraine as for Israel or Palestine, or is there more dissent on Ukraine?
You know, with the Ukraine issue obviously is interesting, and it's probably I don't want to say bright spot. And another bright spot would be Tulsi Gabbard. I would argue in favor of her as the only other potential restrainer within the new Trump administration. So I'm sorry, I left her out.
Though potential, though, right? Because she's also flipped lately. So yeah.
Well, first of all, she has to be confirmed, and second of all, yeah, she has exhibited some anti-Iranian, very pro-Israel positions within the campaign since October 7th. So we could talk about that too. But on Ukraine, yes, I feel like it's been politically expected, politically okay for Republicans to call for an end to the Ukraine war, to call for negotiated settlement between Russia and Ukraine, and have supported Trump's call for talking with Putin and bringing Zelensky to the table. You have seen this since last year when Republicans led by J.D. Vance and others had said that they were finished with approving unconditional aid to Ukraine, though Ukraine aid did pass in April along with Israel aid. But I do think that there is a movement towards that. My only issue, other than, hey, that's great, here's a hand, we've been calling for that at Quincy Institute since the beginning, is that it's politically driven. I would like to see some consistency on the principles that they're of restraint and realism that they're applying to the Ukraine war applied to what's going on in Gaza, what's going on with our lingering number of troops in Iraq and Syria, you know, and with our relations with Iran. And I don't see that same consistency. I see that all thrown out the window. So part of this really is purely political. Yeah, we'll take the win if we can get the Ukraine war ended and get a settlement there, because honestly, it's the best thing for Ukrainians that we don't continue to destroy that country through a proxy war. But I would like to see the same quote unquote America first principles applied to other conflicts that are happening, including the Middle East.
Yeah. With the Ukraine war, I mean, it is so highly politicized. And I assume you're talking about, I mean, we go back to Russiagate. And the beginning of Russiagate, and back in 2016, you know, Paul Manafort worked in Ukraine. There were so much of Russiagate was from the beginning, you know, Ukraine was front and center, and there were Ukrainians recruited into the Democrat Party and sort of the blob and that whole world's hysteria and feeding the hysteria. And so Ukraine you know, like it or not, got dragged in, probably didn't know what the hell they were doing. But what they wound up doing is making the Ukraine issue a one-party issue.
Right.
And even though Trump was not anti-Ukraine and pro-Russia in terms of policy, I mean, he's the one that overturned Obama's ban on offensive weapons and started delivering offensive weapons to Ukraine. Nevertheless, he wasn't all about heating it up. And we've talked about this on the show a lot, but when Biden first came to power in early 2021, actually it even started after he won the election, but his people worked with Zelensky's people and some changes that he made to flip policy from what he was overwhelmingly voted in to do, which was bring peace, which Zelensky ran up against a lot of obstacles trying to get peace, domestic obstacles. And Biden's people with the Atlantic Council and Blinken and so on said, no, let's actually heat things up and cut a better deal. And we can't let Russia get away with Russia. You know, they're all still, even though it's bullshit, they deeply believed in their minds that Russia had fixed the election and was going all around the world undermining, you know, the U.S.-led liberal order. They wanted to punish Russia using Ukraine. And so one would hope that that Trump, if we can get something good out of this, that he doesn't see Ukraine as an instrument to punish Russia because the whole Russiagate thing targeted him. So you would think he would want to end it. But that said, and you know, we have to look at what's happened recently. I mean, Biden, who would usually space out his weapons escalations in the Ukraine war, approving of weapons that are considered escalatory, he'd usually space them out over many months and with a lot of debate and so on. He went boom, boom, boom. We talked about this on our last show, approving American private military contractors to be openly stationed in Ukraine, which could be a tripwire. And then, of course, approving the long-range ATACMS missiles, which require U.S. direct involvement in targeting, approve that, which just is leading to this, I don't know, you know, pretty bizarre and frightening nuclear talk that's going on. And then the landmines, and I've heard he might approve more long-range cruise missiles in the near future. And I was wondering if, and I'll ask you what you think about this, but I was wondering if maybe this was something kind of on the sly worked out between Trump's team and Biden's team. And it's like, okay, heat things up, and then Trump has, I mean, this is my only sort of generous reading of it, right? And then Trump would maybe have some leeway and for negotiating. But just this morning, Mike Walls, who has been a hawk on Ukraine, but he's falling into line, apparently, he went on one of these Sunday morning shows, and he was, I mean, I can just, you know, quote here. He says, we need to bring this war to a responsible end. We need to restore deterrence, blah, blah, blah. But we need to get ahead of this escalation ladder rather than responding to it. I mean, it sounds like they're not happy with this. So this was not something done with them, but rather something done to limit what Trump can do, basically to try to tie Trump into the war by getting Putin to escalate. And we know he does escalate when we escalate. What do you think about all this?
Yeah, I'm sure you've already spoken about this on your shows, but this idea of Trump-proofing the Ukraine policy has been going on for months now. And we were writing about that at Responsible Statecraft on the fiscal or the financial side of the thing of this issue, in which the EU, in concert with NATO countries, were pledging millions, if not billions, of dollars rather, of new funding to Ukraine, and ahead of the election, because they obviously surmised that the Trump administration was going to be cutting off the spigot. But the billions of dollars that they're pledging may not, I mean, they're in loans with the expectation that the frozen Russian assets, the interest from the frozen Russian assets, would pay back the money. Well, we don't know if that interest can pay back the money yet. That's still being disputed in the courts because of the different regulatory laws, banking laws between the United States and Europe. And so it could be that Europe has just saddled Ukraine with billions of dollars in new debt because they just couldn't stomach the idea of winding down this war in 2025.
There's no way Ukraine can cover it. I mean, let's be honest, without taking out a different loan from somewhere else to cover that loan.
Right. So we've already devastated and, you know, with obviously with their help and, you know, acquiescence, we've devastated the economy there. Mm-hmm. And they, like you said, they'll never be able to pay it back. And even like the sort of conservative expectations is that they could start getting things turned around by 2030 to start paying back loans. So what you have here is they'll be continuously dependent on the West to run their government for years and years to come. And it's just getting worse the longer the war goes on. And then, like you mentioned, there was this military escalation, this allowance of the long-range missiles to be used in Russia, the U.S. attack them, and then the Brits immediately followed suit, allowing their storm shadows to be used. And then I guess the French are also allowing their long-range missiles to be used. And the Russians respond by launching a new ballistic missile that has been in the experimental phase that it was not armed with a nuclear warhead or multiple nuclear warheads, but could be. So you are seeing this spiral. And the people that I talk to, the folks at Quincy, are saying this actually makes it harder for Trump when he comes in 2025 and to start corralling both sides to the table because they're in an escalatory spiral. Zelensky is all hopped up on adrenaline, thinking that he will somehow regain a military edge. And then you have Putin, who is retaliating with their own escalation. So it does make it worse. I do think this is very much purposeful. And not because of what we're seeing is being done, but if you read the op-eds from the Washington establishment, everything is geared towards this idea that Trump is going to come in and break this successful, quote unquote, Biden policy in Ukraine. And so you have everybody just falling in line on all the editorial boards for the major newspapers, magazines, the commentariat of Washington has basically decided two things. One, that Ukraine's policy or Biden's policy in Ukraine was working, that NATO is the most successful alliance of all time, and that coalition is working, and that Trump is going to come in, stomp all over it, and there's going to be World War III.
Rather than Biden leading us towards World War III.
Exactly.
I mean, one thing, you know, that kind of strikes me being older is, you know, I'm old enough to remember when serious politicians and presidential candidates always talked about peace, the need for peace, and the danger of nuclear war. And it was really striking to me in, I can't remember, I think it was Trump and Harris. I mean, Trump didn't do too well in that debate, but a few things he said were like, it just sort of struck me like, wow, nobody talks like this anymore, where he brought up the danger of nuclear war. And to Harris and probably the journalists and probably most Washington people who consider themselves credible and serious adults and so on, worrying about nuclear war makes you unserious somehow.
Right.
Is that the case? Like, because that it shocked me thinking when I was younger, Reagan, you know, it was the right and the left. Nixon would talk about peace, and you know, he was hardly a peacenik. Peace and nuclear war and the dangers of nuclear war, and he did some very dangerous things, but at least rhetorically, he understood. And, you know, overall, the idea was, yeah, you do want to avoid nuclear war. It's a real thing and a real possibility. And it just seems like in Washington now, and I don't know how this is, Trump at least talked that way. I don't know how it is with his team, but it's as if nuclear war is just some total abstraction and it's almost silly to talk about it.
There are so many people here in Washington and on social media and in the mainstream media who put politics before principle. And if your principle is peace, then it doesn't matter how and who you talk to, the ends to the means is peace. But somehow it's okay to talk to, when you had President Carter went out and he spoke with Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez. He has been a pioneer for peace, as they call him, since being president. Somehow that's okay. Somehow that kind of peace and wanting the world to be a better, safer place is okay when a Democrat like Jimmy Carter is doing it. When you have Tulsi Gabbard goes to Syria and she speaks with Bashar Assad and she comes back and she doesn't hide it. She goes on CNN and she says, listen, I was in a war that was based on a lie and we didn't talk and we didn't use diplomacy. And I saw thousands of my own men and fellow men and women soldiers die, come home with PTSD and whatnot. I do not want the United States to get into another regime change war like that. And I think it's important that we talk. He's not a good man, but we have to talk just like Reagan talked with Gorbachev. And what is happening to Tulsi Gabbard right now? She is being called, she's called an agent, a foreign agent, for wanting to talk to Putin. She's called a Putin apologist for going to Syria. She is being called compromised, a national security threat by our own lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers like Senator Warren and Tammy Duckworth and others who have pretty big perches. And they're on the media all the time calling Tulsi Gabbard a foreign agent because she dared to talk to a quote unquote enemy. But somehow it was okay for Jimmy Carter. So what all I'm saying is that this idea that we are geared for peace, that nuclear war it should be something that we need to warn against and to avoid, is fine when it's politically expedient. And right now, it's not politically expedient to talk about the nuclear war threat with Russia, because somehow Russia is Putin is so evil; he's the next Hitler. And so we just have to sort of like muscle up for war as opposed for peace. And I just find that hypocritical as somebody who has advocated against militarism for as long as I have, to act as though this is like an a la carte situation. And you pick some wars and proxy wars that you support and some right. that you cannot based on your political persuasion.
Well, this is the thing that keeps striking me, the self-righteousness of these mainstream, as they're called, Democratic pundits, that wasn't there a big defeat, like not to say a massive debacle in their own electoral politics? And didn't anyone associate that with the association of the DNC crowd and political adventurism?
You mean this last election?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing that keeps getting lost. And then you have people like, you know, obviously at the Quincy Institute and Responsible Statecraft and a number of other voices in the sort of realism and restraint crowd are pointing out like, hello, read the polls. People didn't want to go to war. They wanted to start talking in Ukraine. They were not happy with Israel's behavior in Gaza. Now, was it clear, huge majorities? No. But at poll upon poll, you know, have shown a progression of people being disenchanted with the foreign policy of the Biden administration. And poll upon poll had suggested that the American people thought Trump would actually proceed in a better direction on our foreign policy, whether it be Ukraine or even the Middle East, which I don't necessarily agree with. But what it showed was the American people have been disenchanted and just underwhelmed by Biden's performances overseas. And when you get to the point where they're preferring Donald Trump over the Democrats on issues like Ukraine and the Middle East and others, you know there's something wrong. But the takeaway that Democrats had after the election was not that people were disenchanted with Biden's performance, particularly in Ukraine. they were actually saying that, wow, he did such a great job, and here's this new guy is going to come in and break it.
But no one could possibly believe that.
But that shows the disconnect between the people outside of the swamp and inside. Because inside, they think everything's going hunky-dory, or if they don't, they are paid to hide it and cover it up. On the outside, the American people see and they go, hello, the last 4 years have not been so good, whether it's for my own pocketbook or our relations overseas. And guess what? I don't want to go to war. I don't want my son to go to war or my daughter. And I see this going in a bad direction.
I mean, is there, tell me what you think, because it seems to me that Biden's foreign policy, when you look back on the record, is the most disastrous since W. Now, W's probably is in a slightly more special category of its own. But from any way you look at it, I guess, except from the blob's point of view, but anyway, anywhere outside of it, it has been just catastrophic. He did one great thing, which was the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But in hindsight, and that was a great thing. You don't see that much in my lifetime, actually pulling out of a war, because nobody ever gets popular completely pulling out of a war that looks like a defeat. But in hindsight, it's pretty clear. I mean, maybe was so at the time.
I mean,
as well.
It was a defeat.
It was a defeat.
That's what people can't handle, and they aren't willing to forgive anyone who takes the final action that follows on that defeat.
The funny thing is, from the blob's point of view, that was his one mistake. And yeah. I don't think that's what the rest of the country, I don't think the rest of the country thinks we should still be there. But that was when the blob first turned on him, and then they rallied hard behind him with the Ukraine war. It's like, yeah, now this is our moment. I mean, they welcomed that war with a glee I've rarely seen since 9/11. From your point of view, would you assess Biden's foreign policy as, you know, really one of the most disastrous of your lifetime?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Short answer,
we're on the same page.
Yes. Yeah. And in my lifetime, and you know, I'm a little older now too, and I've been here for over 20 years. I've been covering the elections as well as foreign policy and the establishment writ large. I see the Biden administration as a real apotheosis of the corruption of the blob. And it has hit an apex where you had all of these people who are considered smart and learned at the top of their game, coming up from Ivy League, well connected, had all of the experience of coming out of grad school and then working their way up to these ranks of top officials in the Pentagon, you know, and State Department, National Security Council. But what happened was along the way, and I would say this began in, you know, the end of the Cold War through the GWAT, is a corruption in which the wrong people are being promoted. The wrong people are failing upwards. And when Biden comes in, he brings in Blinken and Sullivan. All these people have been sort of hanging around since the Clinton administration. They cut their teeth through there. And so you have these people who are supposed to be our top diplomats, our top strategists in the National Security Council. You have people in the Pentagon, which has its own corruption problems, in which the it's not the best and the brightest or rising to the ranks of generals or people who are yes men and people who put their heads down, and it's all political promotion. It's not about critical thinking and strategy. And so all of these people have risen to this level in 2020. And here you have these massive upheavals on the geopolitical landscape, whether it be Ukraine and Russia and Israel and its neighbors, things are going on in Africa that we haven't even touched upon, and they are not equipped to respond. And so that we had this fantasy that the adults were coming into the room and this terrible Trump administration and MAGA are on their way out, and they wrecked all of our alliances and all of our relationships, and we're going to come in and make it all better. And then promising things like a foreign policy for the middle class and all this jargon. when it turned out they really weren't equipped because they were just creatures of this corrupt system in Washington. And they got to the places where they got to for all reasons other than competence and merit. And so what you have is you have things are blowing up and they're in constant reactionary mode. And while our men and women aren't there dying on battlefields like they were during George W. Bush, we're asking other people to, and we're allowing this humanitarian crisis to unfold in Gaza we've been through these situations before in 2006, for example, in Israel and Palestine, but not at this level where they're literally ethnically cleansing northern Gaza right now. They're shutting it down. No food is getting in. Southern Gaza is right behind it. They're about to annex the entire West Bank, bombing Lebanon, bombing Syria, about to go to war in Iran at any moment. Like, things are on fire.
It's insane. I know. And they just seem, they seem to be happy with it, which is the weird thing. They seem to think, like, they're at least they're pretending to each other, like, yeah, things are going according to plan. We're about to remake the Middle East. And but it's more like they don't know what the fuck they're doing or what they've unleashed. Excuse my French. But yeah, it's unbelievable, like the danger and the level of fires in the world. And yeah, we haven't brought up Africa. I mean, as far as I can tell, they completely ignored. They just, I don't know. Yeah. Africa was not even on their radar, and the Sahel and all that.
Yeah, I mean, just I'm very lucky as an editor of a magazine that has a lot, not a lot, because, you know, frankly, there are not a lot of people who want to write about Africa. But when I do have people writing about it, they're very smart and they're very in the weeds. And time and again, whether it be Burkina Faso or Mali or Sudan, other places in the Sahel, Ethiopia, what I'm getting from this is that the Blinken State Department was just not on top of their game at all. Now, obviously, there's other things going on in the world, but that shows you that there is no reservoir of really smart, capable diplomats who can go in there and roll up the sleeves and get things done. We're not going to tell these countries what to do, obviously, but we have spent so much time generating military support for these African countries and giving them tons of weapons and training vis-a-vis the Pentagon and all of these covert operations that we don't know about, but we haven't done the heavy lifting on the diplomacy. And so when things are going sour and we don't have the military levers to push anymore, we find that we don't really have diplomatic chops. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that in almost every story that we've published. And it wasn't because we were purposefully trying to get at the administration and make them look foolish. It's just when it came time to say, okay, well, what is Washington doing? It's like, we're dipping in and saying all the right things, but we're sending people two levels down over there to do the negotiations. And it just seemed to me that we weren't sending our A game at all. And I'm wondering, and will the Trump administration? Absolutely not. I just don't think that he has the people in place either. It's just that the Biden administration, they go running around bragging that they are the adults in the room, that they have all these people in place that have been trained and educated.
They have the credentials. They have all the pedigree, all the great pedigrees. Yeah.
And they're doing squat.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, like, what happens to these professionals who presumably define themselves antithetically to the Trump Republicans as compassionate people when they talk about what's going on in Palestine in private? I mean, is there some acknowledgement of the horrors that are happening there?
I mean, I think it really depends on who you talk to. I think that, yes, I think that there is an acknowledgement among a wide swath of Democrats that what's going on there is a living hell. But they have so many pressures from the Israeli lobby when they get to work every day that, I mean, you saw that in the vote for a ban on the weapon sales to Israel that took place on Capitol Hill this week. Bernie Sanders sponsored. They got less than 20 votes. Wow. From Democrats and Republicans. So less than 20 votes total in the Senate to put a block on billions, $20 billion worth of offensive weapons sales to Israel. They couldn't even stop that. And you had several very brave, Democrats who stood up and said, enough is enough. I mean, all they have to do is point to the fact that there is the Leahy law, which is in place. Yeah. So they don't even have to make shit up. They could just say, yeah, listen, we have a law
that says
we can't give weapons to military units that are committing humanitarian violations of human rights. Now, I guess then they have to say that Israel is committing these atrocities, but and so far the State Department has been unable to go to that point, even though it's all happening in real time right in front of our faces. You know, so they all they needed to do was like, listen, this is happening. We're going to put a block on these weapons. And they couldn't even do that. And so I just think there are a lot of pressures from the lobby on members. Now, are there members who are true believers, particularly in the on the Republican side? Yeah. So they don't even really care what's happening on the ground there.
Right.
So you have, I think you have a gradation of feelings and approaches on the Hill. Some of them are, it's all like politically calculated. They're in survival mode. And then there's others who are true believers. And some of those true believers have just been appointed to the Trump administration. You know, people like Mike Huckabee and,
right. There is no Palestine.
Yeah. Elisa Stefanik, you know, these are people who literally believe that, the Israel is conducting a righteous operation in Gaza right now. And that's pretty scary. And you know what? They can believe whatever they want, but that's not America first. And if we want to just talk about purely American interest, is it our best interest that Israel destroys Gaza and annexes the West Bank and, if not, destroys Lebanon too? What does that do for us, having supplied all the ammunition, planes, fuel for that abomination? But how does that help our relationships with other powers in the Middle East from then on? I mean, I feel like we have to look out for ourselves. We have ships there, we have soldiers there, we have Marines. How does this affect them? And do we even like? Why don't we care more about that? And so I feel like you could look at this a purely realist point of view. And I don't think it is in our best interest to help set and fuel a fire in the Middle East. We need to get the hell out of there.
Yeah, I've noticed this feeling among, well, especially among older mainstream Democratic and Republican politicians, that the American people don't care about the Middle East. And they haven't noticed that that doesn't really work for people under 40. That's changed. But they insist that no number of civilian casualties among people who would be classified as, quote, Arab could move the political meter at all.
Yeah. I mean, I'm afraid that there's probably some truth to that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, younger people obviously are vocalizing a real opposition to what Israel is doing. Older people still have a romantic vision of Israel that was born out of its birth in 1948, you know, post-World War II. And that's not going away anytime soon. So you see this dichotomy between younger voters and older voters when it comes to Israel. And okay, we'll be honest. Most people didn't go to the polls on November 5th to vote for or against the wars in Ukraine or Israel. They went because of the economy, and that was borne out in all the exit polling. I think in order to get people really animated about this, I think we have to talk about the risk to the United States. And like I said, we are spending so much money and we're giving so many missiles away that we are actually making ourselves vulnerable. And we've had pieces on responsible yeah. statecraft about this, people breaking down the numbers of missiles that we have been giving to Ukraine, depleting our stockpiles, and now to Israel, depleting our stockpiles, and creating a situation where all the replenishments are going to be taking years and years and years. Okay, so meanwhile, we've been shooting really expensive missiles at the Houthis for over a year, and they haven't stopped.
Yeah.
And the idea is, and just bear with me for a second, because I don't necessarily agree with this scenario, but it's just to put it in perspective. What if something did happen with China? What if China did attack Taiwan and we were there and somehow we get dragged into a war? I have really smart people that I work with every day who say, we don't have the capability anymore. We have put ourselves in a situation where we need to step back and start rebuilding because we don't have the manufacturing capability to rebuild the stockpiles. And
we could always ask China to ship us some missiles.
I mean, our own self-defense yeah. is vulnerable because we have gotten involved in a proxy war in Ukraine and we are giving everything to Israel without even a backstop, without using any leverage to make sure that they conduct a war that protects human lives, civilians' lives. So if we want to just look at it purely self-interest, which I think many Americans that actually resonates with say, hello, we got to take care of our own house now. And that's not going to happen if we keep giving billions of dollars of weapons away. We don't have the capability to replenish at this point. Anybody will tell you that. So if it's not the human rights aspect that gets you interested and angry and wanting to oppose what's happening, well, then there are other reasons why we shouldn't be helping Israel unconditionally right now.
Well, and not just Israel too, because I was listening to one of your recent interviews with one of your colleagues who's a weapons expert. And he said, if I recall correctly, that this ATACMS missile, and by the way, among corny names for missiles, well, we won't get into it, but that supplies are very, very limited, that it's mm-hmm. it's a new missile, it hasn't been produced in large quantities, and we're already giving what we have away to Ukraine to be fired with United States personnel cooperation against Russian targets.
Yeah, that's right. But you never hear that on Meet the Press or CNN or any of these places. You just hear this sort of this cheerleading for giving them more, giving Ukraine whatever it takes to succeed. And you never get down to the nitty gritty of how much. And with Ukraine, we have some sense of how much we've given them over the years, if you really want to know. But with Israel, they've been a lot more guarded about the truth. And the Biden administration has given tons of weapons over the last year, and much of it has been under the threshold purposefully that Congress didn't even have to be notified. Right. And so even Mike Friedenberg, who did a great piece for us for Responsible Statecraft on the missile depletion, you know, even he was just going on public source information. I don't think we know the extent of how much we've depleted our stockpiles. And I don't, you know, and it's funny, I don't get a sense from the Pentagon that they're particularly happy with the pace and the rate of all of this missile depletion. I feel like they would rather not, but because the policy has been driven out of the National Security Council and they're just doing what they got to do, they're following orders. But I think if they had their druthers, they would probably put a little bit of a pause on all of this weapons sharing and sending and transfers and give a chance for us to replenish. Now, obviously the military industrial complex, the defense industry, is more than happy because they're going to be in business for years and years and years. But when it comes to strategic level, it doesn't help us if we can't replenish till 2030, if something happens next year.
Let's talk getting back to Biden's actual team and what their view is, since we're talking about Israel more now, on the Israel war. And then I also want to talk maybe about the loyalty aspect too. But so you have Mike Walls, National Security Advisor, very powerful role in forming security, national security policy, of course. Pete Hegseth, the Department of Defense, and Marco Rubio at State. I would expect Marco's going to be more of a yes man, but we know where he stands on Israel. He's just a down the line neocon, basically.
Right.
And Stefanik, as you pointed out as well. But I don't think they necessarily make a whole lot of policy. I don't know. Where are Walls and Hegseth on Israel? I mean, Hegseth, of course, famously has that crusader tattoo. But where is he actually? And has he, people change some. I'm not going to try and give him the benefit of doubt here, but I'm just curious. I don't want to also just say, oh, blah, blah. Like, has he evolved from his very pro-Iraq war days? Or has he evolved in a bad way? Or has he evolved at all in a sort of realist way? And Walls, to me, is also more of a kind of mystery.
Pete Hegseth claims to be a recovering neocon. Okay, I think this is I don't know him personally, but he came on my radar right after he got back from, I believe he was in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and then he started that organization, Veterans for Freedom. I think that was in 2012-ish, which was right about the time of the Afghanistan surge. And I'm sorry if I'm mixing up my years. But that's when he came on my radar as a veteran who was very hawkish and came back to lobby for more troops in Afghanistan and in wars. And he was a sort of like the opposite of, say, a Tulsi Gabbard, who came back and said, no, I don't want to repeat what I just lived through.
Right.
And so that's how I know Pete Hegseth. Then he says, okay, he goes to work for Concerned Veterans of America. But at the time, Concerned Veterans of America, which they still are, were very focused on privatizing the VA. So it was a very narrow effort campaign. And of course, advocating for veterans, but they were very into like the healthcare question.
Why would they privatize it? I mean, everything I know, doctors and stuff, like everything I hear among government agencies, it works pretty well, doesn't it?
Well, probably disagree with that. I mean, the VA has had problems mostly because of this massive bureaucracy over the years not just the corruption, just the failure to actually serve veterans, then covering up massive like failures, and so like the cumulative outgrowth of that is that it needs reform. And the CVA came in and they said, well, we should reform it by privatizing it more. And there had been some efforts at privatizing veterans' healthcare, particularly in places where veterans are way out in, say, rural parts of the United States and can't get to a VA or any of their satellites within a 2-hour drive. And then they would give them some waivers to go to private doctors and that worked a little bit, but then there are problems came up with that. So there's a big debate going on that I'm not super into. Like I don't know the complete ins and outs, but I know that the CVA, which is more of like sort of the free market conservative orbit, was really pushing for that. So that was kind of their bailiwick. Then he went to work for Fox News as a host. And that's where you see Pete Hegseth, the more like public persona. And then spend all that time trying to get pardons for war criminals. And hey, you know, he made a big splash. He got Trump to listen, which really pissed off the Navy, which says, hey, we have a uniform code of justice. Let's let it go through that process. Eddie Gallagher was probably the most famous of those guys who was, you know, in the brig for stabbing a teenager who was supposedly with ISIS, and the guy was on his like last leg and he just stuck the shiv in him, and then they took a picture of it. And yes. I mean, it's terrible. And so Hesketh made his name for defending these guys and defending Eddie Gallagher and then getting him that pardon despite what the Navy had wanted. And so like, I'm sure he's not like super popular with the brass right now.
Right. Cause that's bad for discipline, right? If you let these guys off. Just, yeah.
Considering all of the stories that we've heard about, you know, atrocities committed by our uniformed soldiers through the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's really gives other uniformed soldiers who did not commit atrocities a bad name to look like we're accepting of that. But that's right. A whole other story. I think Pete Hesketh had put his finger up to the wind towards, you know, after 2016, when Trump was pushing for the end of foreign wars, restraint, bringing troops home, not being the global policeman, you know, rethinking the global war on terror. And that obviously resonated. And that's one of the reasons why he won in 2016. I think Pete Hesketh was one of those Republicans who sort of joined that bandwagon. I can't get into his heart about whether he really cares about restraint, but I do know that he is like super pro-Israel Christian evangelical Zionist. And that puts him in like a category of people who will absolutely be foursquare with Israel in this issue with the Palestinians. And that's what makes me a little nervous, because he and Mike Huckabee and others have really ascribed to this Christian Zionism, which shouldn't have anything to do with U.S. foreign policy. That's religious. And the mixing of the two is just, it is a recipe for disaster. And so,
I was just checking out various famous quotes from Hegseth, and it's neat the way, you know, neat in the sense of tidy, the way the religious bias fades into the civilizational bias in the rhetoric that these people use. For example, he says, as the publisher of the Tory, and I don't actually know what the Tory is.
I think he means the Torah? Yeah.
No, he's Tory, T-O-R-Y. Okay.
British Tory now.
Yeah, he's for the Queen, I guess. Okay.
I strive to defend the pillars of Western civilization against the distractions of diversity. First of all, distractions of diversity, you got the alliteration there. And whenever you've got a vaguely militarist slogan with a lot of alliteration, you're dealing with something ill-omened. But yeah, this when it travels all the way down to the real world, will mean he will defend any idiotic, doomed Iraq invasion or Netanyahu support.
Or Iran war.
That's absolutely right. And I don't trust, you know, there had been this movement, and I know because I was at the American Conservative for years during the real high point of this, of nationalist conservatism. And some of it's, you know, obviously, a lot of it has been around for a long time and is not necessarily nefarious. It's just like, hey, we want to be proud of our country. We want to see our foreign policy through the lens of national interest. Our interest is protecting, creating the atmosphere of happiness and prosperity, whatever, for Americans and being America. And, you know, that's where the whole American first came from. But then you get this weird, like, civilizational nationalism, which has made me nervous, because the dumb people who profess to espouse it end up sounding like proto-fascists.
Yeah, they do.
And that combined with this idea that we need order and a strong leader and all this stuff is just really creepy. And then you combine it with religion, whether it's Catholicism or Christian evangelicism. It just, there are all types in this town. And and I feel like Pete Hegseth is one of those. Probably, I mean, he's got a Harvard and Princeton degrees, but I feel like when you, the comment that you just, or the quote that you just shared, it just sounded like somebody who was sort of cosplaying one of these like nationalists that I've been hearing about and reading about for the last several years.
I'll read the comment again in case people weren't clear on what I said. This is a quote from Pete Hegseth. "I strive to defend the pillars of Western civilization against the distractions of diversity." Well, first of all, a lot of Army and Armed Forces recruiters would say, please stop defending us against diversity. Yeah. We've got a quota to make here.
but I would add to that, though, just as a, I mean, since I follow the Russia stuff and Russian punditry and Michael McFalls and that whole the more kind of center left liberal world and secular world, they're using a lot of that rhetoric slightly differently about the Ukraine war. George Packer, like all those people, it was a civilizational war that Russia represented. Sometimes they slipped straight into straight up like old school fascist talk, like that Russia is Asiatic. Despotic and Asiatic, and then people would kind of, some people would call them out, but they picked up a lot of that. But basically, it was, Oriental despotism versus Western democracy and civilizational. You see, you probably heard that a lot too, or still hear it a lot, Kelly.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's just the same impulses and instincts with different language.
Yeah,
and. I just don't get it. And what bothers me the most is that we are entering a very fragile situation in the Middle East in terms of the United States' role in it. And when you put people in places like Secretary of Defense, Secretary of or the State Department head, and National Security Advisor, and they've all had very clear things to say about Iran being the greatest adversary of the United States. And not only that they believe that Israel is just acting in self-defense, that we have to stand with them shoulder to shoulder no matter what. It's hard for me to believe that we will go into this using any leverage that we have, seeing our own interests in the situation, where does this leave our men and women who are in Syria and Iraq? Like, I don't feel like we are going to be well equipped to deal with that reality. If anything, we're putting people in a position where they are going to do whatever Netanyahu's government wants. And without this sort of larger view of what could happen within the rest of the region. And it makes me sad because I feel like there were people who were possibly more equipped to do that. And what Biden's administration has done is bad enough. They did not use any of the leverage, the $4 billion that we give Israel every year to say, listen, you need to pump the brakes on what's going on in Gaza. You need to get some freaking aid in there. Stop starving people. Stop, the settlers rampaging through villages in the West Bank. Stop building the settlements. All of these things, they could have used the leverage that we have and said, we're going to cut it off if you don't do this. We support you to defend yourself against what happened on October 7th, but not rampaging all over humanity and breaking international law all over the place. And instead, we do the opposite. We give them the money, and then we say that international law doesn't apply to them anymore.
Yeah.
And so so that's bad enough. But now if we have people who are already primed to just dispense with any pretense of impartiality or objectivity and just go in there and say, hey, whatever you want. I mean, that's...
Aren't Trump's people saying, I don't know about walls, I still don't know a whole lot about walls, but aren't Trump's people saying basically Biden and Harris have actually held back Israel, that they've actually not let Israel fight the war. They're forcing Israel to fight with one hand tied behind their backs, and we should let them do what they want, which is just mind-blowing that people believe that. But I do think that's what they're coming into power thinking, right?
I mean, a lot of people that I've talked to are hoping that Trump, who is very transactional, will get to a point very early on and say, hey, this isn't helping me in my own country. Like, there'll be a moment where he's going to say, if I keep supporting Netanyahu, I'm hurting myself. And I'm, you know, politically. And his the transactional self-interested nature of Trump will kick in. And he'll be like, no. And I don't know. I mean, I like I said, I feel like J.D. Vance and Vivek Ramaswamy have said some interesting things on this. They haven't gone so far as to say that we should not be helping Israel. But I think Vivek Ramaswamy actually said that we shouldn't be giving them any more aid because it's better for them if we don't give them aid, because then they're sort of like tied to us, which I felt like that there was a lot of pretzel logic there so he could appease conservatives. But J.D. Vance has essentially said the same thing. I don't know if there are better angels within this incoming administration that will say, listen, this isn't good for us.
Why does the Trump team, and this was the case also in the first Trump administration, so deeply have it in for Iran? It seems to me that, you know, obviously a big part of that is being very pro-Israel, but I think it's more than that too. It has to do with old grudges, like that we've talked about on our show, that go back to the, you know, the hostages and the humiliation, and then also the Iraq War and Iran's role in helping some of the insurgents, I guess. But like, it seems that this administration in particular, well, even Trump won, are really focused on Iran and like doing something about Iran. Do you think that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about everything. I think it's a culmination of old grudges, this institutional bias that plays out in Washington that carries over through the entire intelligence community, the Pentagon, the State Department, and that dates back to the hostage crisis. And then you have their role in the Iraq War, but then I mean,
and in Lebanon,
the 80s,
the series of humiliations inflicted by Iran and Hezbollah on the American intelligence agencies in the early 1980s was astounding, and most people don't know it, not in its entirety.
It's absolutely true that their proxy army has Hezbollah, Hamas, all of the militias in Iraq now who have been taking pot shots at our troops in Iraq and Syria, then all that's for real. But you also have to build in all of the dynamics that led to that current reality, which include the fact that, you know, we sided with Saddam Hussein against Iran, that we fought with Iran, there is a rich history there that somehow Washington, like the establishment or the mainstream media, has reduced to this sort of like good guy, bad guy, you know, that somehow we're constantly besieged by these terrorists for no apparent reason.
And we're free.
Yeah.
They hate us because we're free. Yeah.
We don't talk about the fact that Iran actually helped us rout ISIS out of Iraq in the late 2000s. But now they're our enemy again. And so you have all this combined. Plus, you have the Israel dynamic playing out, and so whether it's Mike Walls, who is he seems to be more of a traditional hawk, going out there and saying, "Well, during Trump's reign, you know, we bankrupted Iran, and then Biden gave them all sorts of money, and then they were able to pay Hamas to attack Israel on October 7th." I mean, they've reduced it to this little fairy tale. Or you have the religious thing going on with people like Mike Huckabee. And so, and then in between, you just have an establishment in Washington that just seems to be mostly on an autopilot to see Iran as this threat, like the biggest threat in the Middle East to us today. And then you have very few people who have been around since the Obama administration who helped to get that JCPOA, which was the Iran nuclear deal. And they're still here too, but they're like sort of lonely voices in the wind. It's you know, amazing. They're like, hello, we actually need to work with Iran if we want to hem in their nuclear program. We need to actually work with Iran. We don't like them. We might prefer a different regime, but we have to work with them to make sure that they don't pose a threat to their neighbors or to the United States. And they might, they might hem in those proxy elements, but we're not going to get anywhere by threatening them militarily and turning a blind eye when Israel is assassinating their scientists and assassinating their leaders on their territory. I mean, but those, like I said, those are minority voices in Washington, and they sound pretty reasonable to me, but I feel like all those other dynamics are working against the situation. And like I said, you have people like Walls, you have people like Seb Gorka, who was just announced as like the deputy national security.
Also, Alex Wong was just named as a deputy. He's like a Bush era guy.
Very unreconstructed hawks that are coming in that believe in the fairy tales and are very much about American primacy, very much about using the U.S. military to throw its weight around overseas. Don't see, aside from Tulsi and J.D. Vance, don't see anybody who has actually sort of learned the lessons of the last 20 years at all.
That's strange because, I follow like newspapers like the New York Times, which very much buy into a narrow sphere of people around Biden, around the DNC, who are absolutely convinced that America's not America unless we're messing with the rest of the world. And a lot of what they see as the danger of Trump's vote is that they're isolationists. But from what you say, that isolationism doesn't permeate very far upward in the Trump elite.
They're absolutely right. And this whole idea of isolationism is a joke because I don't see any real pure isolationists anywhere near any foreign policy or national security circles or even people in my orbit. I mean, the isolationism would indicate somebody who just wanted us to close the doors and lock the gates and do nothing with the rest of the world. And the people that I associate with who are called isolationists want to engage with the rest of the world. We just don't want to engage with guns and bombs and fighter jets and military coercion. We want to do it through trade. We want to do it through diplomacy. God forbid. So this whole idea that the isolationists are taking over is just a smear. And now they're going to have to re-engineer their smears because Marco Rubio and Elise Stefanik and Mike Walls and Seb Gorka and Pete Hegseth are no restrainers and they can't be called isolationists. They are hawks and neocons and they're back.
God, this is grim. I mean, I have to say, in 2016, because we didn't know what Trump was going to be like, there were some grounds for optimism, right? And I would say the one good thing he did do is that he did not expand the war in Syria because it was clear that Hillary was going to be her war, Syria, and it was going to expand, and they were going to work to overthrow Assad, and at least Trump. He didn't get to pull out as he apparently tried to do or wanted to do, but it was pretty feckless. But at least he didn't expand it. That, and I would say, breaking that mystical taboo of talking to a bad guy where he talked to Kim Jong-un, like that was what was wrong with that? You know, he talked to him, you know, that was a good thing. It didn't work out, but whatever. And then with Biden, there was some more optimism because Biden, of course, had a history of being a sort of McCain-style interventionist. But then he also had a more recent record of agitating or trying to sort of push for more restraint. He was against Obama's Afghanistan surge. I think he was against the Libya bombing. So it seemed like, well, maybe Biden has learned a little something. At least it gave some false hopes. But this time around, it just sort of like, I guess, except for the possibility that the Trump administration might wind down the Ukraine war, and hopefully that could make things safer. But again, that's so volatile right now. It's not that easy, I don't think. I think I could see a lot of ways that that could go very off the rails. But at least that might be one area where we might be a little optimistic. Maybe Trump would also pull us out finally from Syria and Iraq. I don't know. Maybe not from the way you're talking.
I honestly think there'll be some pressure on him to do that, because our restrainer friends on the right have been really banging the drum on that. And it's allowed them to talk about what's going on with the Middle East without mixing it up too much with Republican conservatives over Israel. So instead, they've really been focusing on, you know, a smarter policy that, A, you know, uses the leverage that we have over Israel to get to a ceasefire. I know they haven't talked as much as some others have done about that, but the idea that the Houthis, for example, have been attacking ships in the Red Sea, and they said they will continue to do it until there is a cease of violence against Palestinians in Gaza. We should be pushing for that, because we don't need to be out there with our ships and our $2 million missiles shooting at them for an entire year. It hasn't stopped the violence, and B, we're wasting our resources and putting ourselves in harm's way. We should be pushing for a ceasefire. So there's ways of talking about this even on the right. And one of the biggest things that they've been banging on is about, why do we have 2,500 troops in Iraq and Syria sitting out there like sitting ducks, being attacked by these Iranian-backed militias? What are they doing there? What's the strategy? They can't fight. They're too small in numbers. Let's bring them home. And I think they will continue to pressure the Trump administration, because obviously Trump wanted them out of there before. And they had just signed an agreement with the Iraqi government to get the troops out of Iraq by 2026. So there are things in motion. I think that I think our friends, people who have been fighting for more restraint and retrenchment, are going to continue. And I'm hoping that Trump will be listening on that front.
Well, maybe we can end on a happy note.
because it's otherwise been a pretty grim, you know, prognosis.
I have another happy note. I do think that Trump, the new Trump administration, will break the narrative, or at least he will put a monkey wrench in the narrative of this autocracies versus democracies bullshit. Because we've seen it play out since 2022, or beyond that, obviously, but since 2022, the war in Ukraine, this idea that we are fighting for the democracy of the globe, and that if Putin isn't put down, not only like out of Ukraine, but usurped in Russia, there will be a World War III, that Russia will rampage throughout Europe. All of this, that the Ann Apple bombs, the Atlantic, Elliot Cohen, you know the narrative. I feel like the Trump administration, for all of its faults comes to foreign policy, does not indulge in that. If anything, they are saying that he is part of the autocracy pantheon. I think that obviously the narrative isn't going to go away, but it will live in partisan politics, which will be odious enough, but it's not going to dictate our policy in coming out of the White House anymore. And I think that's where it got really dangerous, because it went from the partisan politics of the Democratic Party and Russiagate to the policies that were coming out of the National Security Council. And I poor Ukraine, because they're suffering from that. I think Trump comes in, changes that dynamic and the narrative. And that, I think that's good for everyone. I would love to see, you know, Ann Applebaum and Elliot Cohen, you know, resign to the pages of Atlantic, just like giving their pot shots and everything, but not having a seat at the table.
Yes, I think we all can agree on that. Here, you know, I mean, that whole idea of this crusade basically for democracy against the authoritarian Sauron, it played to that Acela Corridor crowd, the Atlantic Monthly writers and some of the Washington Post columnists, but I don't think it had much depth outside of it. Although among Democratic Party partisans, yeah, I think it resonated with them, because even though Russiagate fell apart, it lives still so deeply in their minds. I mean, the hardcore, so deeply. So for them, they understood really what that meant. And so as you said, though, it's become totally partisan, and that will be gone, and that's a good thing. So good, okay. couple of potentially nice stories, but no, I agree. We're looking forward to potentially 4 very dark years. And Biden, you know, Biden claimed that Trump is the next Hitler and that he's going to destroy democracy. And to make sure the rest of us are safe, he's setting the world on fire and handing it to Hitler.
You know?
Brilliant guy. So, anyways, on that happy note, I think we can end.
Well, we managed to make it a happy note in the Radio Warner tradition there. So good.
Thank you again so much to our good friend, Kelly Vlaus of Responsible Statecraft, for coming on. And we'll be talking to you again, hopefully not in 4 years, but before then, but certainly, yeah, okay, yeah, good. All right.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we can wrap it up there. Thanks again to our guest, Kelly Vlaus of Responsible Statecraft, and great talk. And thanks again, everybody. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.